I was thinking during this last sit when I was supposed to be doing other things that that line, a funny thing happened to me. It's actually the first line of the first joke I ever heard in the 1940s from the mouth of Milton Berle. I had never really heard a joke before, and I thought that that is the greatest thing I ever heard. Do you know, I was living in an apartment building in Brooklyn, and it was a fairly large five-story apartment building with around 8 apartments on each floor, but there was only one television in the entire building. The television had just started, and about the only show that was on, at least the only one I knew about, was the Milton Berle show. It's every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. So every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, the entire apartment building crowded into this one apartment. And people were piled like 2 and 3 deep, you know, on each other's laps and lounging across each other. And then the Milton Berle show would come on. I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember the Milton Berle show, but it would always start with 7 dancers, male dancers, dressed as gasoline station attendants, holding grease guns. And they would sing this song. "We are the men from Mexico. We work from Maine to Texaco. There's nothing like this Texaco of ours." Maine to Mexico. Excuse me, I forgot about it. They would sing this song. They would, when they were finished singing, they would be doing a dance, you know, with the grease gun. And then when they were finished, Milton Berle would come out and he would tell a joke. And that was, in the first time I ever saw it, that was the joke he told was, "A funny thing happened on the way to the theater tonight. A tramp came up to me and asked me for a bite, so I bit him." It's still a great joke. But what I remember, you know, there was that those Tuesday evenings were times of great intimacy. You know, all these people draped all over each other watching Milton Berle and laughing, you know, but that was not the greatest form of intimacy that the people who lived in that apartment building knew, because see, this was in the 1940s and it was long before air conditioning. At least nobody that I knew had air conditioning. Maybe it existed then, but I'm not even sure that it did. And it got very, very hot sometimes in the summer. And when it got really, you know, so hot that nobody could sleep, everybody would just throw their mattresses out on the fire escapes and go to sleep out there. And I remember sleeping on the fire escape, looking around, and there were all these people, men in boxer shorts, women in skimpy nightgowns, you know, and there we were all sleeping together, you know. Then the next morning, and it was just such a, you know, a beautiful, I just remember that as one of the most beautiful experiences of my childhood, because there was such a feeling of intimacy, you know, such a feeling. But then, of course, the next morning, everybody would go back in their windows, and then they would get all dressed up in suits and hats, you know, fedoras, and they would walk by each other in the hallways pretending that the whole thing had never happened. That they hadn't spent the night together. And as you'll see, I didn't plan to say any of this. In fact, the talk has not yet officially begun. But I think you'll see that some of these concerns will continue to come up. But I would like to begin. Now comes the real talk. I would like to begin by asking, what, after all, is up with the Shema? What do we mean when we say it? What do we feel? What do we think? Is it like the Pledge of Allegiance? You know, something we learned by rote many years ago and don't even hear anymore? Something we were once told was very important and don't really understand why? You know, the watchword of our faith, whatever that means. Or is it something we like, we have friendly feelings towards, because we've been saying it in various settings all of our lives? Something which produces a comfortable sense of nostalgia. Or do we even listen to the words? And if so, what do they mean to us? is the Shema a triumphalist yop? You know, let them all go to hell except tent seven. You know, like we used to sing songs like that in camp. Our God is the only God. Our God is the only one. We're number one. We're number one. You know, they could, that's, you could read it that way. And I think probably most of our co-religionists do. Or does it mean something else entirely? And if so, what? And what's up with all this talk about spirituality? What does it mean? And if all we're going to talk about is spirituality, who's going to mind the story? Who's going to make sure the world doesn't go to hell in a handbasket? Who's going to make sure that justice is done? It's a wonderful midrash in Pirkei the Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Joshua and Yochanan ben Zakkai are walking through Jerusalem when they come upon the ruins of the Temple Mount. They lived after the destruction of the first temple. And Rabbi Joshua, when he saw the temple in ruins, he started to cry. And he said, "Oi," you know, that's a very old word. You may think that that's like a product of Eastern Europe, but it's actually a biblical word, which also appears many times in the Talmud. "Oi." Hear me out. Jeremiah says "Oi" all the time. And in this case, Rabbi Joshua says also "Oi." "Oi lanu al zeh shehu charev makom shemekaprim bo." It says, "Deizmir." Because of that which was destroyed. The place where we experienced God's forgiveness. So, you know, what do we do now? So Yochanan ben Zakkai says, "Beni, ager alecho, my son, forget about it. Don't worry about it. Yesh lanu kapara acheret shehi kamota." We have another form of achieving atonement, achieving God's forgiveness, that's just as good as the one that we used to get in the Great Temple before it was destroyed. The Ezel, Gimelut Chasadim. Gimelut Chasadim, acts of loving kindness. Shene Emar, Ki Chesed Chafatzti Velo Zebach. Because it's your kindness I want, not your sacrifices. That's a quote from Micah or Hosea or one of those guys. So the temple was the place where we experienced the divine presence, divine forgiveness. What do we do now that there's no temple anymore? Gimelut Chesed. Clothe the naked. Feed the hungry. Bring the poor and the homeless into your home. And for many of us, there's a tension in this midrash. And it exposes our misconceptions about both spirituality and social action. For many of us, I think, spirituality is something we do for ourselves. And this is the Emersonian idea of spirituality. You know, you can blame this idea on Ralph Waldo Emerson. And his idea eventually became the American idea, our idea. That spirituality is a form of personal gratification, a private, deeply subjective matter. And the idea has come to dominate the American spiritual and religious landscape, even as resolutely a communitarian enterprise as Judaism has had to come to terms with it. In order to compete in the American spiritual marketplace, Judaism has found itself giving personal spiritual gratification a considerably larger place in the Jewish spiritual landscape than it had traditionally occupied. The emphasis on personal gratification has given rise to a strong negative misconception about spirituality, especially among people who don't like spirituality very much. And that is that spirituality is navel worship, that it leads inescapably to self-absorption, a turning away from the world. Of course, anyone who has seen a real spiritual community knows that this is not the case. In Japan, when Buddhism was in its fullest flower, every Buddhist monastery was responsible for all the people, every single living person between it and the nearest neighboring monastery. And this was a very direct, present tense kind of responsibility. If someone cried out, the monastery responded. If someone was hungry, the monastery saw to it that they had food. Even stray cats were thrown over the monastery walls, because everyone knew that if no one else in the world would take care of a cat, the monastery would. When I used to practice at the San Francisco Zen Center, I remember I sat a session there, and they came in and explained to us before the session started that if we were sitting during the session and a cry went out on the street, and this frequently happened, by the way, because the San Francisco Zen Center in those days was in a dangerous neighborhood, a block away from one of the city's largest housing projects. And in fact, you know, Chris Persig, the son of Robert Persig, who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, was killed right outside in that neighborhood, right outside the Zen Center. So anyway, the rule was, but if we were sitting and we heard a cry, we were to get up immediately, find out what the problem was, and do whatever we could to take care of it. And they explained to us at the beginning of a week retreat like this. And when Jews lived in coherent spiritual communities, those communities took the same kind of direct responsibility for their members. They fed the hungry, housed the homeless, visited the sick, comforted mourners, raised funds for penniless brides, and performed various other acts of gemilut chesed, acts of loving kindness, acts of direct hands-on caring in the present moment. That's what distinguishes gemilut chesed from tzedakah. Gemilut chesed is active, direct, hands-on caring in the present moment. Acts which sought to meet the immediate needs one saw in front of one's face. So the Emersonian idea of spirituality as personal gratification is not affirmed by the real spiritual communities one observes, for the most part. Yet the misconception persists. And we're equally afflicted by misconceptions about social action, social justice. And these misconceptions frequently doom our efforts in this arena. There's an old Japanese saying, an inch in the beginning is a mile at the end. Those of you a little bit off in the very beginning, by the time you get to the end, you're way off. If we begin our efforts for social justice with good intentions, but with the wrong idea of what we're doing, the result will be way off. We come to believe, for example, that something's wrong. It's up to us to fix it. We come to believe, for example, that the obligation for social justice requires us to stoop down and help those below us, those who are weaker and less powerful than we are. But this kind of thinking only serves to fortify delusions about our own power and to affirm the sense of powerlessness in the people we're bending down to help. And in the long run, it can do more harm than good. It weakens them, and it makes us arrogant. Our idea of social justice feeds our addiction to oppositional behavior. If the impulse to engage in social action flows from some vague notion of doing or being good, then we need bad guys to measure ourselves against. The important thing is to be on the right team. You know, this is the social justice of the false cuirass, to use Kurt Vonnegut's great term. Us against them. A brand of social justice found frequently on the op-ed pages. And there are, after all, always people around to despise. Rednecks, clanners, ditto heads, Sarah Palin, Joe the Plumber, which our political beliefs place us in sharp contrast to, usually to our benefit. And this, like the first strategy, keeps us in a constant state of opposition and conflict. But these strategies for social justice are strategies of separation. And that is a contradiction in terms. Real social justice, real healing, depends on wholeness and reconciliation. And it is precisely here, in the urge for wholeness, that the realms of social justice and spirituality intersect. The truth is, spirituality and social justice are indispensable to one another. There can be no real spirituality, no sense of spiritual liberation, if some of us are left behind. And no social justice without an authentic base in spirituality. And because this all might seem quite counterintuitive, I call upon that famous counterintuitive, Rabbi Zimmerman, to help us out. Broken lives, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. No use jiving, no use joking. Everything's broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches, broken gates, broken dishes, broken pots. Streets are filled with broken hearts. Only Rabbi Zimmerman can rhyme pots with hearts. Broken pots, streets are filled with broken hearts. Broken words never meant to be spoken. Everything's broken. Seems like every time you turn around, something else just hit the ground. Every time you leave and go off someplace, things fall to pieces in my face. So this song captures very precisely the sense of brokenness we feel in the world these days. The sense of things gone horribly awry, of nothing working, and our attempts to repair them only seeming to make matters worse. The economy, the environment, the increasingly futile quest for peace, our families, our hopes, our dreams. Everything seems broken. And since we ourselves are broken, we seem powerless to fix it. This is the bad news. The good news, of course, is that it's always been this way. This, at least, is the testimony of the rabbis of the Kabbalah. This brokenness is not a special feature of our world or our time. This is how things have been, literally, since the time of creation. According to Kabbalah, according to Lurianic Kabbalah in particular, before creation, God existed in a primordial state known alternatively as the Ein Sof, the endlessness, literally without end, and the Ayin, the emptiness. But this endless emptiness was such a powerfully charged state that nothing could coexist with it, nothing could withstand it. So in order to create the universe, in order to create anything at all, the Ein Sof had to perform an operation known as Tzimtzum. It had to contract itself, to remove itself from a tiny speck at the center of its vast and radiant emptiness. And this tiny speck was creation, the universe as we know it. But in the middle of this Tzimtzum, this contraction of divine light, a catastrophe occurred. Kabbalists call this catastrophe Shfirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, the divine light was being hauled away from this tiny speck at the center of the Ein Sof in vessels called kalim. But the light was too strong for the kalim, and the kalim broke. Shards of intolerable divine light were scattered all over the universe, throwing the world into chaos, creating a broken and dangerous world. The purpose of human existence, according to the Kabbalah, is tikkun olam, repairing the vessels, restoring the divine light to its place. Everything we can do to correct the brokenness of the world, from reciting prayers with the proper kavanot to serving meals in the soup kitchen, accomplishes this. Yet, and this is the kusha, this is the koan. In a thoroughly broken world, when we carry our own spiritual brokenness into everything we undertake, how can we expect to be the agents of real tikkun? How can we prevent our own brokenness from infecting and undermining and finally defeating every attempt we make to repair the world? We human beings are profoundly mixed. We're created in the image of God. We are the bearers of divine light. But we are also broken. And in our brokenness, we can't find the light. The poet Kabir writes, "I talk to my inner lover, and I say, why such a rush? We sense that there is some sort of spirit that loves birds and animals and ants. Perhaps the same one who gave a radiance to you in your mother's womb. Is it logical you would be walking around entirely orphaned now? The truth is you turned away yourself and decided to go into the dark alone. And now you're tangled up in others and have forgotten what you once knew. And that's why everything you do has some weird failure in it." Sound familiar? Everything you do has some weird failure in it. So according to Kabir, this weird failure, this brokenness of the world, comes from our having turned away by ourselves and deciding to go into the dark alone. Did you ever listen? I know it's hard to listen when you're in shul on the high holidays, but did you ever listen to the Haftorah from Isaiah that we read every year on Yom Kippur morning? It's my favorite liturgical moment of the year. Because, you know, we're sitting there, we've been fasting, gosh, by that time, maybe 12 whole hours. And so we're really feeling pious. We're really feeling, I'm really something. And then we hear God making fun of us through the prophet Isaiah. "You think this is the fast I have chosen? Is this your affliction of the soul? To droop your head like a bulrush, to grovel in sackcloth and ashes? Is this what you call fasting, a fast Adonai would accept? This is my chosen fast. Loosen all the bonds that bind men unfairly. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. Share your bread with the hungry. Take the homeless into your home. Clothe the naked when you see them. Do not turn away from people in need. Then a cleansing night light will break forth like the dawn, and your wounds will all be healed." So for Isaiah, tikkun is turning. It turns us toward the light. And in the same gesture, we turn away from our own darkness. We turn away from that place where everything has some weird failure to it. When we turn towards others, when we feed the hungry, when we house the homeless, we move towards the light. You know, I had an old friend named Sarah, and she had her 5 minutes of fame around 20 years ago. During that brief moment when homelessness was the fashionable social dysfunction of the moment, when newspaper reporters were all dressing up in rags and living on the streets for feature stories, and rock stars were giving concerts to benefit the people on the streets. Anyway, during this time, Sarah had a radical idea about the homeless, which no one had ever thought of before. She decided to try to talk to them. She even set up a foundation based on this idea in Marin County. She went to the homeless and engaged them in conversation. That was the whole idea. That was it from start to finish. She asked them how they were doing. Did they need anything? Where were they from? How had they gotten into the predicament they were in, etc., etc. The results were immediate and spectacular. The homeless stopped harassing the merchants of Marin County and their customers for a while. And these grateful merchants poured money into Sarah's foundation like a never-ending stream. Now, my friend Sarah was a poet and not a very effective administrator. And before very long, her program went up in flames altogether. But before it did, she had her moment of instant celebrity. An article about her work appeared on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. And the next week, she was flown to New York, where she appeared on the Today Show, Good Morning America, and the CBS Morning Show. "Tell us what it was like to talk to homeless people," Jane Pauley said. "What did they say to you?" Joan London wanted to know. "What do the homeless want anyway?" Harry Smith asked her. Of course, they were all completely unaware of the incredible irony of what was going on. They had flown Sarah 3,000 miles across the country to answer these questions when they could have easily discovered the answers themselves outside the lobbies of the very buildings they worked in. Every building in New York back then was virtually ringed with homeless people. But to these people, the homeless of New York may as well have been on Mars. So thoroughly had they consigned them to another world. Why had they done this? One day, around 20 years ago, I was walking across the Park Presidio on my way to work. I used to work at a synagogue. When a man, my Park Presidio is, but it's like a, I can't explain it. It's got a little parkway, a little bit of green in between the roadways. When a man my age suddenly came out of the bushes right in my path, we frightened each other. He recoiled from me. He took two steps back when he saw me. And I realized he was afraid of being discovered. Maybe because they were in the middle of one of their periodic sweeps of the homeless in San Francisco. They do this every 2 or 3 years. And he didn't want to get caught up in it, swept off the streets and into the maws of the legal system, only to be spat out again, only now bereft of whatever small and pitiable possessions he may have had before. Or maybe he recalled because it was simply the nature of his state, because he represented a part of us that doesn't want to be discovered. At least, this is what I felt very strongly at that moment, as we were recoiling from each other in a strange dance, he taking two steps back from me taking two steps back from him. He represented a part of me that I didn't want to see, the dirty part. The uncontrollable part, that part that might fall into the black pit of failure at any moment, that part that might go belly up and die. In short, he was a perfect picture of everything in life that frightened me to death, of everything I couldn't control, of all my own internal darkness. Death, failure, uncleanliness, anger, greed. No wonder I didn't want to look at him. No wonder I felt a wave of relief pass over me as he disappeared back into the bushes. But as soon as this wave passed, I felt something else as well. I felt how much fear there was in my reluctance to see this man. Precisely because we have such a strong sense of our own brokenness deep down. Whatever happens, whatever sense of success or well-being we might experience carries with it a subtle undercurrent of fear. When things are going well, when we are experiencing pleasure, when we're getting what we want, when we're successful, when we're in love, we feel obliged to defend our happiness because it feels so fragile, so unstable, so in need of constant protection. So we have to deny the very possibility of suffering. We have to cut ourselves off from facing it in ourselves and in others as well, because we feel that it threatens us. We're afraid it'll undermine or destroy our good fortune. And because deep down we know the truth, we are broken. Everything is broken. So in order to hold on to our own pleasure, we have to refuse to recognize the humanity of a homeless person we encounter on the street. We decide that his suffering isn't relevant to us. It's somehow outside us or beyond us. We cut ourselves off from facing the world's suffering because we're afraid it will undermine our own happiness. But if there are homeless on the street, we can't be happy, can we? We can't be happy when the hungry are clamoring at our borders, risking their lives to have a few scraps of what we have. They accuse us. They threaten us. Even if we manage to get them out of the parks and off the downtown streets, how can we enjoy what we have when there are people begging for food and work on the parkway dividers? Or when there are people standing at our borders begging to come inside and help us consume the vastly disproportionate share of the world's resources we've been accustomed to consuming here? The only way we can keep them from spoiling our happiness is to try and pretend that they don't exist. But denial can never be selective. And the psychic squint we have to make in order to do this reduces everything in our line of sight, not just the homeless. And we can't be happy when we're half blind, when our experience of the world is so reduced. Happiness is precisely our experience of the fullness of the world. As Joanna said in her lovely explanation of the ashray just a few minutes ago, when we dim the lights so that we don't have to look at one thing, the whole world grows dim. You know, I'm about to tell a story. I'm going to do a very brave thing. I'm about to tell the story that I actually told here at Eilat Chaim the night before I was rushed to the hospital. So keep your fingers crossed. And this is a story about, it's actually a story about my favorite movie. This movie is, I don't even know the name of it, but it's a film about human conception made by some Scandinavian scientists with tiny microscopic cameras. You know, they went right inside the fallopian tube and they filmed the whole thing. And at the beginning of the film, we see thousands of sperm cells storming the beach at Normandy. You know, they're coming on like gangbusters. Each cell supremely confident of his mission in life. Each one convinced he will triumph in the end. But of course, that doesn't happen. One by one, they crash into the walls of the tube and they flame out and die. And, you know, if Howard Cosell were to come along with a microphone and interview one of these sperm cells just after he crashed and burned and, you know, ask them what the meaning of it all might be, the poor cell would say, "Meaning? Are you kidding? The whole thing is a crapshoot. There's no meaning at all." And in fact, from the point of view of each individual cell, there is no meaning in the process they've just gone through. Their particular lives seem to have been wasted and absurd. They lived for a minute and then they crashed into a wall and died. But as this magnificent film unfolds, we see that they have been part of a larger process and that that process has been nothing short of a miracle and charged from beginning to end with a profound sense of meaning, the propagation of life itself. One single cell, finally, against infinitesimal odds, penetrates the skin of the egg, and then the egg starts to revolve and send out filaments of tissue all around its circumference so that it looks for all the world like a great Mayan sun, a great radiant light turning and turning in its firmament. I felt the same sense of things once on the floor of a redwood forest in Mendocino County, California. It's back in 1970. It was towards the end of a long hike, and I just dropped down to the ground to rest in the middle of a giant redwood grove. And there was a small branch sticking out of the ground in front of me. And I reached out to pull myself up with this branch, but it gave way in my hand. The bottom of the branch had already decomposed, already become part of the thick, rich loam which lay beneath the forest floor. I lay back with the green tip in my hand and looked up through the branches crowding around me, up to the dazzling gold light at the top of the trees, and I realized everything in that forest was reaching for the sun. Every tree, every limb, every shrub, everything was aspiring upward towards the light and would continue to do so until the moment it died and fell back to the forest floor. Then divine intelligence, pine cones, seeds, would begin to push all this dead matter upwards again in the form of new life. The forest was a single, purposeful organism, and every one of its cells, living and dead, was part of this exquisite reach for the light. We can't control sickness, old age, and death, and they terrify us. But what would we have to be afraid of if we experienced ourselves to be part of the whole of being, moving and changing, being born and dying? What would we have to be afraid of if we saw that our bodies are joined with the planet in continual rhythmic exchange as matter and energy flow back and forth between ourselves and the environment? This is breathing, nefesh, neshama, ruach, all the words our tradition uses for soul. You know, for a couple of summers, I had the tremendous good fortune to go up into the wilderness, the deep wilderness, in a place called the Tebenkopf Wilderness, which is in the inside passages. That's that beautiful strip of inland, kind of like a fjord that goes between Juneau and Seattle. It's one of the most gorgeous parts of this planet. And I wanted to, you know, it was a really, we were deep in the wilderness. They dropped us off in a biplane, and they picked us up a week later. And there's a writer who lives there in that area named Richard Carlson, and he wrote a very beautiful book called The Island Within. I'd just like to read you a couple of paragraphs from it. And this is also, every time I went there, it was the end of the salmon spawning season, which this passage describes, you know, that the waters are black with salmon, just constantly leaping out of the ocean and then leaping back in. Like somebody said, they look like pilgrims, you know, trying to go from one dimension to the other. So somebody said, it looks like they were trying to sew together heaven and the ocean. You know, the way they go up and down. But anyway, like all else that lives, the salmon are only bits of earth shaped for a moment into fish, then taken back again to emerge as other life. The same transformation has repeated itself in Bear Creek each fall for thousands of years, and on the island since it rose up at the continent's edge, and on Earth since the first organisms scuttled in the depths of the Paleozoic Sea. Perhaps I've had a flawed view of death and life. James Lovelock has suggested that Earth itself is an organism, of which we are all a part. If this is true, the salmon are not independent, individual organisms, but tiny parts of one great organism that contains them all, the living flesh that grows from earth and covers its surface. I look down at the soil under my feet, layered with decaying alder leaves. Each fallen leaf eventually rots, transforms, and is shaped into other organisms, while the tree lives on. Each tree eventually falls, transforms, and is shaped into other organisms while the forest lives on. The forest too will vanish and be transformed, shaped into other communities of organisms that will live on. How can there be a final absolute death if life as a whole or earth itself is the organism? What I've dreaded most about death is the prospect of leaving, of lapsing into a nothingness beyond life. But in the endless process of metamorphosis, there can be no final death, only a transmutation of life, a flowing through, a constantly changing participation in the living community. So this is the actual experience of being alive, which Richard Carlson just described very precisely. It's not some fantasy. We do not live as isolated fragments, completely separate, hermetically sealed off from each other. That is simply the illusion our bodiless, our bodiness, bodiliness, bodiliness imposes on us. Rather, we live as parts of a great, dynamic, mutable whole. Every moment we are dying and being reborn, we and all of life. Hamachadesh b'tuvo ha'olam kulo b'chol yom. That's the line that we read every day in the Siddur. Who renews the entire world every day in goodness. And when we realize this, the interconnection of all that lives becomes clear. As individuals, we live and die, often without apparent meaning. As a people, we are always moving towards the light. In our tradition, we call this sense of wholeness kapara, as in Yom Kippur. Kapara is atonement, or literally, at-one-ment, a process which recognizes our fundamental brokenness and at the same time provides us with a remedy, a tikkun. Kaper means to cover over. We are covered over by a consciousness of God, which blurs the imaginary distinctions we have made between ourselves and others. Today, in the beautiful snow, I was thinking of one of the last lines of James Joyce's The Dead. He said, the snow, it describes the snow falling on everything. He said, the last line, the snow is general all over Ireland. Covers over everything. Covers over every distinction. We are all connected. In meditation, we experience this connection in a very direct and concrete way. We breathe in the same air, and we hear the same sounds, and our thoughts rise and fall in the same rhythms. And after a while, the deepest kind of intimacy ensues, almost as deep as those summer nights on the fire escapes in Brooklyn. Or I should say, even when we don't speak at all, or I should say maybe especially when we don't speak, we may sit with someone for months and not even know their name, but suddenly we realize that we feel as close to them as we have ever felt to anyone. And having formed that kind of connection, it's not so easy to turn it off. We go out onto the street and we see a homeless person we would ordinarily ignore and walk by. But now we know, we feel our connection to him. His pain is our pain. And we feel driven to mitigate it as powerfully as we would be driven to pull a spike out of our own leg. But the irony is that we connect with others in the same moment we connect with ourselves. You know, to me, this is the deepest meaning of this line that we're all considering this week. Ve'achavta l're'echa kamocha. And you shall love your neighbor kemocha, as you love yourself. And what I read it saying is, you love your neighbor the moment you come to yourself, the moment you love yourself. Because that's my experience. I don't know if I told this story here or not, but you know, many years ago I worked as a hospice chaplain at Sloan Kettering, and the floors were, they had all the people with the same kind of cancer on each floor. So you know, the eighth floor was all neurological cancers, and the ninth floor was all breast cancers, and the fourth floor was all pediatric cancers, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing you have to know about this position that I had when I was a chaplain there is that we had quotas. We were supposed to visit a certain number of patients every day, and I could never meet my quota because I would always stop and talk to people for a long, long time. So I was always behind. And what saved me was that I found out one day a technical rule was that you got credit for a full visit if you went and you visited somebody who was sleeping and you left a card. Now, on the eighth floor, which is the floor that treated neurological cancers, everybody was sleeping. They were mostly in a coma because either because of their condition or because they had just come out of brain surgery. They keep people after brain surgery. People, at least they used to, remain in comas for quite a while. And so I just went, you know, every day, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I was supposed to see 20 people. I'd seen three. So no problem. 5 o'clock, I take the elevator up to the eighth floor and I go running merrily down the hall, you know, leaving cards at in front of every comatose patient. You know, and this sustained me for a while until one day it occurred to me that there were actually people in those rooms that I was running in and out of. And not only that, but they might have some awareness of what I was doing. So now I was really in trouble because now I went up to the eighth floor and I sat with each patient for a long time. I sat with them for as long as it took until I could feel their presence. I could feel them alive. I could feel them. You know, that unmistakable sense of a human presence that you feel. You know, it's like when somebody comes into a room and they don't make any noise, but you know someone's there. Well, you know, I would sit with these people until I would feel it. But here's what I always noticed. It would always happen the same exact moment that I came to myself. In other words, I would run, you know, I'd be in this hectic frame of mind. I'd be running around the hospital, running around the city, and I would come into the room and I would sit down and my mind would be racing a mile a minute, and I would sit and I would sit and I would sit, and a little by little I would come to myself, and then I would be present with my own experience, present in the moment of my own life, and boom, there they were. Ve'achavta l'reacha kemocha. The very moment that I experienced my own life, I also experienced theirs. The very moment that I connected to my own life, I connected to theirs. And that's what love is, connection. So in a way, Emerson was right. The medium of connection is always the personal, always the immediate personal moment. But it's that immediate present tense sense of the personal that carries us into the transpersonal, into connection. This, you know, another koan, something that was bugging me all my life, I only recently came to understand. These kind of things may not bug you, but they bug me. You know, that famous dictum of Hillel, Rabbi Hillel, you know, Im ein ani li mi li. If I am not for me, who will be for me? Ukisha ani le'atzmi, ma ani. But if I am just for myself, what am I? No, so far so good. We can all go along with that program. But the third part always seemed to me to be a complete non sequitur. What does that mean? Ve'im lo akshav, amatai. If not now, when? Well, you know, which of these doesn't go together? You know, which of these doesn't fit? But then I finally realize it's not a non sequitur. It's only in the now that we simultaneously inhabit both ourselves and our connection to others. That moment of being present, of self-recognition, is the spiritual moment out of which true social action arises. The only place, in my opinion, from which we can truly be of service to others. You know, there's a wonderful passage in the Talmud. Rabbi Chia comes to his wife and he says, listen, I have something very important to tell you. If any poor person comes to the door, offer him or her bread very quickly so that others may be quick to offer it to our children when their time comes. But she got very angry. She said, you're cursing your own children. Because see, the Talmudic belief that if you said something, it would come true. So he was saying that his own children would be poor someday and in need of bread. But he replied. He said, Yesh Gilgal Ba'olam. There is a wheel in the world. if you are merciful to others, if you are compassionate to others, compassion comes to you. If you are not compassionate to others, compassion will not come to you. So I always feel the force of this. You know, the small personal acts, either positive or negative, either angry or loving, that arise out of the present moment of our experience really do alter the world. They make the world, if it's a loving act, it makes the world more loving. And then we get to live in a more loving world. And if it's a violent act, then the world becomes a more violent place. You know, I go to San Quentin Prison, which is right outside of San Francisco, to protest all the executions. They've had 12 since 1991, where they reinstituted capital punishment. And I feel, and you can feel so clearly, you know, they always, they're zeruz l'mitzvah. You know, they're anxious to perform mitzvah. They always execute at exactly 12:01 of the day that the execution is supposed to take place. So they, you know, they do it as soon as possible. And so we're standing there at midnight, and you just feel the horror of what happens when you take a human life, and you feel that horror rippling out into the world and creating more and more violence. Because that's how I experience it. There was one guy that was killed, Manny Babbitt. Manny Babbitt was this big, lovable African-American. And they sent him off to Vietnam, and they trained him to kill, and he was very good at it. He was a decorated hero, killed many people. And when he came back, everybody who knew him could tell that he was really off. His behavior was off, through going through rages. He would get very upset. And one day he walked into the house of a 72-year-old Jewish widow and killed her. No reason, never seen her before. And then we killed him. I never saw a clearer example of the cycle of violence. So, I mean, we train a guy to kill. He goes and he kills. It makes him crazy. He comes back. He commits more violence. And then we kill him. And the cycle continues. Because Yesh Gilgal Ba'olam, there is a wheel in the world. So, you know, and it says in the Kabbalah that when you make love, this is one. This is a really great teaching. And I urge you, try this at home. When you make love, you bring about peace in the world. You know, it's such a beautiful. In other words, when you create love in the world, it ripples out and makes more love. So the best way to make a better world for ourselves is to make a better world for others, and then is to make it better for others, and then live in that better world. And since we're all connected, the best way to make a better world for others is to begin with ourselves. You know, during the high holidays, during the month of Elul before the high holidays, I'm always advising people to do all these awareness techniques, mindfulness techniques, because that's what we're supposed to do during Elul. And in addition to meditation and prayer, which are the two main things I advocate, I also tell people be very aware of what you eat, be very aware of how you make love, and be very, very aware of spending money, you know, very, very fundamental things. And pick, I always tell people, pick one thing. And so one year, Cheryl said to me, okay, wise guy, I've got one thing for you to pick this year. And that is, I want you to watch how fast you eat. And she did this not completely out of altruism, but largely because she's sick and tired of sitting across the table from me. Her plate is still full. Mine is empty, and I'm eyeing hers covetously. So she said, you know, just watch the speed with which you eat. So I did, and it was just astounding to me what wellsprings of greed and fear I uncovered as I watched myself wolfing down food. You know, and as the month continued, and by the way, I mean, the sad part of the story is that I still eat very, very quickly. But for 1 month, I was very conscious about it. And what I saw so clearly is that if you take this fear and greed that I saw in myself as I was wolfing down this food, and you multiply it by a couple of million people, what you have is a culture that's consuming 80% of the world's resources out of fear and greed, you know, while it represents a much smaller proportion of the population than that. So in other words, this is important stuff we're talking about. You know, it seems like, oh, what difference does it make if I'm aware of what's going on in the present moment of my own experience or not? It makes every difference. It's the only place we can change anything. We really are connected, and the medium of this connection is the person. Yet we struggle desperately against this truth, and this struggle cripples us. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to hold the rest of the world at bay. Energy we could really use. Hatred, anger, projection waste our energy, sap us of our evolutionary power. Why do they have such a persistent hold on us? The sense of brokenness we feel at our core seems to go back as far as we can remember. We are by no means the first culture in the world to intuit it, nor are we the first culture with a yearly ritual of exorcism and atonement for it, a ritual by which we attempted to expunge our brokenness by projecting it on others and then getting rid of them. And in the interest of time, I'll skip two pages of brilliantly collected examples of this truth and cut to the chase, which is to suggest that perhaps it's time to stop being bullied around by our own worst impulses. Maybe time to disarm the mechanism by which we cast our dark shadows, the dark reflection of our own brokenness onto others. Perhaps it's time to stop, period, because this is precisely how the disarming begins. We simply stop and look at this mechanism, rushing headlong through our lives, impelled by one unconscious impulse after another. We truly do lead unexamined lives, lives of quiet desperation. We can't see the picture of our lives because as long as we're still moving, we are in the picture. But when we finally stop moving, when we're still, when we sit in meditation, when we pray, when we observe Shabbat, that weekly withdrawal from the ceaseless rush of activity in which we are usually immersed, we step out of the picture for a moment and we begin to see it. The natural shape of our mind begins to come into view. No longer reacting to one impulse after another, we begin to acquire some distance from them, some detachment. We begin to see the mind in all its wild and chaotic disorder, in its addiction to conflict, in its fear of pain and suffering. We begin to see our own complicity in the various conflicts we're engaged in. Now, outside the picture, we don't have to react to the anger or fear. We begin to realize that we don't have to exercise those impulses. We don't have to project them outside of us and onto others. And we don't have to push them back down ourselves either. We don't have to set off a chain of karma in the world or do violence to our own inner world either. We begin to see a third way, a middle way, Shema Yisrael. We just listen to these impulses. We just watch them. Conscious for the first time of their ceaseless rise and fall. We just let them rise up and then fall away again with everything else in the universe. And eventually, we ourselves are with everything else in the universe. Eventually, maybe after a lifetime of practice, we begin to see ourselves as part of humanity, reaching out for the next step in its spiritual evolution. Eventually, we begin to outgrow the illusion of separation. But why is it an illusion? We are separate, aren't we? Some of us are Jews, not Muslims, or Christians, or Buddhists. And you are a person, and a very particular one at that. You are not your Uncle Irving. And you are not a cat, a tree, a rock, and everything else that is. You are you. Yes, I am me. But what animates me is what animates Uncle Irving. The cat, the tree, the rock, and all that is. We are packaged differently, but we share the same essential energy, the same life. There are many of us, and we are not the same, but we are all connected at the core. The Dalai Lama says, because we all share an identical need for love, it is possible to feel that anybody we meet in whatever circumstance is a brother or a sister. No matter how new the face or how different the dress and behavior, there is no significant division between us and other people. It is foolish to dwell on external differences because our basic natures are the same. Our basic nature is light. And when we live our lives taking care of the next need we meet, whether in ourselves or in others, like everything in that redwood forest, we are going up toward the light. Nature always strives to take care of the next need. The forest wants to replenish itself. The T cells in our body strive to heal. The world is reaching for the light. Our choice is to align ourselves with this movement or not. We are carried toward the light by a sense of daily practice, by the disciplines of the sacred, by meditation, by daily prayer, by the disciplined observance of Shabbat, or perhaps by some new daily ritual that manages to impart a disciplined sense of the sacred to us, a daily sense of our connection to everyone and everything, and the absolute imperative for engagement with the world, which flows out of this sense. And realizing this, we are now finally ready to say the Shema. You'll be happy to know. We are finally ready to take the Shema seriously. Shema, listen. Let's just stop and listen. Stop reacting and pay attention. Be mindful. Examine our experience, the thoughts and impulses that are constantly rising and falling in our mind, instead of suppressing them or projecting them onto someone else. Yisrael. We just got to the second word. We who struggle with God. We who deeply intuit our brokenness and struggle against it with everything we have. We who struggle desperately to cast out our darkness, to project it onto others. Adonai Eloheinu. And as a consequence of this listening, we will see, we will feel, we will know in the biblical sense that this God who we have called Eloheinu, our God, who we have treated like some kind of personal possession, like some kind of local tribal deity, is really Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the verb to be in a form that partakes of past, present, and future at the same time, a form Hebrew grammarians call the present perfect, and which seems to denote an Aristotelian sense of the eternal moment of being, the moment that is the ground of all being, the source of things as they are, the source of what we are and what we are becoming, the ground of this moment, of the past and future, joined in this moment as well, joined here. And this Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, this sense of being in the present moment, is one. It is here that we experience our connection, our oneness directly. It is here that we experience ourselves to be part of the interpenetrating whole, part of the cosmos, rising and falling away with every breath and every moment. This is where we can heal the world, from this place. Because when we experience this sense of the world, we realize that every need in the world is our own need. When we're hungry, we eat. When we're tired, we sleep. When someone else is hungry, we feed them. If we try to ignore them or their need, we only darken our own world. We're all broken vessels, yearning together for the light, deeply connected in this yearning, and finding in this connection our tikkun. Thank you.